There we go. So if you look at 9.2, and if you've even glanced at the notes a little bit, you're like, we've covered a lot of this stuff. So you're going to see me go really fast right now, like a couple pages, like turn, and we're going to start a little bit in. So you can look at this and go, oh, yeah, we already talked about Alexander the First and his Holy Alliance in the time period of the Congress of Vienna. Oh, we talked about the Decembrist uprising and the putting down of it. We talked about Nicholas the First, that reactionary monarch, the difference between Slavophiles and Westernizers. We then looked at Russia in the age of mass politics and how Alexander the Second made reforms, including ending serfdom with the Emancipation Act. Then we looked at Mirs and Zemstvos, all that stuff. We looked at anarchism, Alexander the Third, Zionism, Count Sergei Witt. We looked at all this. So we're starting on Nicholas the First, which is letter F. So if you turn all the way to that, right? If you turn all the way to that, we're starting with Nicholas the Second. And we're going to lay the groundwork for what's going to be called the Russian Revolution. Some people call it the Communist Revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution. That's where we're going. So some of this first stuff in the first few minutes will kind of be reviewed too, because I'm kind of creating the environment that this Russian Revolution is going to start in. If you remember, Nicholas II, I think I've already told you, is going to be the last czar, literally the last czar, right? The Romanov dynasty, which ruled for 300 years, he's the last one. So it's the environment while he is czar that the Russian Revolution is going to come in. While he is czar, there was that Russo-Japanese War. That's this slide here, right? There was the Russo-Japanese War, and we've talked about that, how Russia had tried to go clear across east, clear across Russia into Manchuria, then to try to have some influence in Korea. Japan had actually taken Korea in the Sino-Japanese War, and so there's going to be a fight between Japan and Russia, and if you remember right, you know who won, right? Japan, right? So Japan won that one. Here's just another map of showing that it's about Korea and bringing that over there. So Russia loses this war. Japan wins that war. And so that's part of the beginning of the negativity while Nicholas II's reigning, that's going to create the conditions that's going to allow for a revolution. Just like there were conditions that led to the French Revolution, there's conditions that lead to the Russian Revolution. That war ends with actually our president, Theodore Roosevelt, trying to brings the Japanese and the Russians together in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And it's called the Treaty of Portsmouth, and Russia accepts Japanese control of Korea there. And now the Russian government says, okay, I guess we're done with our focus on the East, and now they start turning towards the West. Now remember, this is all before World War I. So for the West, for them, is the Balkans, and of course the Russians are Slavs, and what are the group of people who live in the Balkans? What are the group of, yeah, they are Serbs. What's their ethnic group? Lots of them, Slavs. And so now they turn their attention over there, and when World War I breaks out, who's going to be the country that's going to help the Serbs? Russia, because now they're kind of done with the whole East kind of thing. But Russia's dismal showing in the war is going to be one big cause of the next thing, the Revolution of 1905, which is going to create the environment for the long term for the revolution to come. So the Revolution of 1905... We've seen that liberalism is kind of creeping into Russia. It's not like full-blown like it is in Western Europe, but liberalism had been growing a little bit over the last 50 years in Russia. There's a small professional middle class that's emerging, not huge, but a little bit of a middle class. The liberals, there's some of the nobles were liberals. A lot of those guys were in the Zemstvos, but the poor economy, because we've seen that over and over in Russia, their poor economy, the strains of war like the Russo-Japanese War are going to cause these people in the middle class and even the proletariat, which in Russia is going to tend to be peasants, according to Karl Marx, who are the proletariat. The workers in factories, but Russia doesn't have that many, so proletariat's a little bit bigger here. There's a growing urban proletariat, but it's still kind of a small group of these workers. So lots of dissatisfied people while Nicholas II is czar. You've got the small little urban proletariat who are dissatisfied. You've got the peasants who are dissatisfied. Why are they dissatisfied? Because they've never really enjoyed the benefits of their emancipation. Remember, they were still tied to those mirs. They can't own their own piece of land. They can't be enterprising and do their own thing. So that's kind of there. And even some of the middle-class liberals are dissatisfied. And so all of that leads to them desiring reform, change. And we've seen that the 200,000 people are going to march on the Tsar's Winter Palace in St. Petersburg in January of 1905. They're there peacefully. March peacefully. They're there peacefully. They're led by a priest, Father Gapone, G-O-P-O-N. Father Gapone is the head of the assembly of Russian factory and plant workers. So basically a union, right? The head of the assembly of Russian factory and plant workers. So these people march on the Winter Palace. They've got religious icons in hand. What's a religious icon for these Orthodox Christians? Like a cross. Yeah, a cross. They might have Bibles with them. They are singing hymns, right? Hymns, Christian hymns. And they so is this a very violent group coming? Not really, like, I got my cross, we're singing some Christian songs, and they're going to present their petition to the Tsar. Of course, we know the Tsar is not in town. His army is protecting his palace, and we already know what's going to happen and why it's going to be called Bloody Sunday. Because, yeah, his troops open fire on this crowd of 200,000 people and kill about 300 people and wound an additional 1,000 people. Bloody Sunday, right? Dead people, bloody snow, Sunday, January. I've shown you this picture here. Out of this comes a general strike, like waves of people fed up with the system. You'll have a general strike, people not working. You'll have peasant revolts, troop mutinies we've seen. And that paralyzes Russia, January, February, March, April, May, the whole year through to October, until finally Nicholas II will go, okay, I'm going to give you some of the stuff you asked for. He's going to make some concessions. Those concessions he makes in a document called the October Manifesto. And the October Manifesto is done in 1905, and it is a reaction to these strikes, a reaction to the people revolting, even though they're not really violent yet, totally violent yet. But the largest concession is going to be the creation of a Duma. In 1905, Russia gets a Duma, or a national parliament of sorts. The serfs are not going to have to make any more payments on that state land that they got out of emancipation, and a few other things. But the big thing is going to be that the Duma is going to be created out of this October Manifesto, and they'll get some civil rights too, like freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of press, liberal kind of changes, right? So this Tsar has moved in a liberal direction a little bit. The people who are going to be in this first Duma, and there's a picture of the Duma, the people who are going to be in this first Duma tend to be liberals, right? The Duma is going to meet in spring of 1906. Most of them are committed liberals. They're called cadets in Russia, and they're going to, mostly the Duma is an advisory body to the Tsar. They don't have a lot of power, right? The Tsar's made a concession and created the Duma, but it doesn't have that much power. So this appeases moderates, right? People who wanted a little bit of change and are willing to take it slow, this appeases them. They're like, thank you, Tsar. This is awesome that we now have a Duma. But the reality is the voice of the people not really going to be heard through this Duma, because there's no real promise of democracy here. The Tsar retains absolute veto. What's that mean? The Duma can do something, and the Tsar can say no, and that's over. That's different than our system, right? In our system, yeah, Congress can do something, the president can say no, but the Congress can still override him. Nothing like that here. The Tsar retains the power of absolute veto. So now the revolutionaries are kind of divided, and if you divide the people up, I mean, that some are like, no, we need more change. No, I'm kind of happy with this change. The revolutionaries are divided, and so the Duma ends up having very little real influence. And you'd have to argue that the property classes probably benefit in the Duma at the expense of the workers, the peasants, and other groups of minority groups that are in Russia. But still, they at least have freedom of speech, freedom of press, and so they will say things from time to time that annoy the crap out of the Tsar. And the Tsar will dissolve the Duma twice in 1906, because the Duma will say, we want this. The Tsar says, no, blah, blah, blah. He's doing his veto, but then the Duma speaking, and he dissolves the Duma a couple times. So you have that first Duma. And then the second Duma was a little bit more liberal than the first Duma. And then the Tsar doesn't like that, and it's dissolved again. And the third Duma, when that comes in the third time as you get to 1907, that one, he changes the rules on who can be elected. Because the Duma is going to be elected by universal male suffrage, but then he changes the rules on who can be elected. Like, only certain people can run for office. And those are going to be tend to be more conservative propertied classes who are going to be able to run for a position in the Duma. People still kind of upset. Their rumblings or grumblings. For those of you who came in late, we're quite a ways through the notes because I skipped a lot at the very beginning. Yes? Do you find where we're at? We are on letter. I don't know what letter it is. Anybody? Oh, we're under Nicholas II, letter F, but we're quite a ways down. Page 8. Thank you. So the rumblings are continuing. The government is still cracking down on anybody who's trying to be a little bit revolutionary. So that's one half of the story. Of course, that's going to create the conditions that are going to cause people to want to revolt. But this czar, if it changes, I don't know why it changes so slow, but this czar, Nicholas II, is going to have a prime minister named Peter Stolpin. And Peter Stolpin is going to try to figure out how can we defeat the revolutionaries and make the people loyal to the czar. And so he's going to kind of take a two-handed approach. One, he's going to be really, really harsh with the people who are revolutionaries. While Stolpin is the prime minister for Nicholas II, basically they're going to hang people who are revolutionaries. You're going to be hung, hanged. Which one? Hung? You're hung from the gallows. And they called these gallows at this time Stolpin's neckties, because a necktie you tie around your neck, hangings around your neck. So they called the gallows at this time Stolpin's neckties. That's kind of the negative side, or the let's beat down the revolutionaries. But then to attract people to the czar, this new prime minister is going to break down that collective village ownership of land and say, hey, serf, not serf anymore, hey, peasant, you can own the land yourself. You can have a piece of land yourself. Not like that is your mirror and you're all sharing it, but you can own the piece of land yourself. What's that do? That is going to take people who are enterprising, like most of you in here, right? Most of you are enterprising. You would like to own your own piece of property and make your own profit and make your own money instead of sharing it with the rest of us. Yes? I mean, just think of it as grades, right? Do you want to like be responsible for your own grade and earn your own and get an A? Or do you just want to share all the points in common and whatever it is divided? If it's a C+, it's a C+. Or do you want to be enterprising and this is, I'm in control of my grade. I'm going to work hard and get as many points as I can. That's most of you. What they're doing is trying to say, okay, there's some peasants like that, and Stolpin's like, I want to make sure they can have access to land. Those enterprising peasants, actually, peasants who are going to own land, there's a word for them. I'm not sure if it's in your notes. It's in I think in mine I've written it in parentheses, so I don't know if I put it in your notes. It's kulaks. Okay, the kulaks are going to be these property-owning peasants. Stolpin creates that class of people. That you're going to own your own property. So now it's kind of like when we talked about the enclosure movement. You're going to be responsible for your own stuff, and you can then make a profit from that. Plus, if you don't have to be part of the mirror anymore, that means you could sell your own piece of land and then do what? Move somewhere. Where could you move that you never could have before? The city. So now you could even move to the city. What he's trying to do is give poor people a reason to support the government, because he's saying, hey, poor people, I'm trying to help you out. And maybe give you a reason to try to support this czar. So anyway, land will be transferred then from the communes to private owners. And then Stolpin's assassinated. But not by peasants. He's assassinated by nobles who are thinking, this guy's too nice. This guy's too nice to the peasants. Most people think it's nobles who are responsible for the assassination of Peter Stolpin. Anyway, you kind of still have a not that good a condition while Nicholas II is czar. They're cracking down on dissidents. Those are those revolutionaries. And he's assassinated. You really don't have that good of an economy going. And then the big thing that gets Russia to a communist revolution is going to be their involvement in World War I. So it's all that just like puts them over the top. At the same time, socialist ideas are growing in Russia.